You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and I have the great privilege and I know fun of speaking with Lena Acosta Sandal. Hope I said that correctly, Lena.
Yes.
And I should, as I sometimes do, say truth in advertising. Lena and I know each other from a relationship with I've worked with her husband for years, or I did in the past. So I know Lena for, oh my God, it must be over 20 years of some sort. So might be more. I'm not that old. You might be that old, but I'm not that old. So, and thank you, Lena. Thank you, Lena, for being willing to speak on camera. I look forward to it, our conversation. But first, let me just do this thing, which is, it's not a commercial. It is, Lena Acosta Sandal has a master's in, what's your master's in? Clinical psychology. And she's a licensed marriage and family therapist. She's a psychotherapist, a development expert, a writer, founder of Stop Parenting Alone, and you'll see in the description the website, the URL for that. Stop Parenting Alone, it's a parent education and consulting program in Miami, Florida, but she does stuff online just in case. She's a writer on social emotional learning for Macmillan Education, a human development expert for Telemundo National Broadcasts, and consultant for Moms Rising, an advocacy group for family rights in our nation's capital. Her mission is, I love this line. Her mission is for all parents to fall in love with their parenting journey. Are you in love with your parenting journey?
Most days. Some days, I wonder, what did I get myself into?
So Stop Parenting Alone. When did you start that?
It opened in 2012, January 2012. And that's why we left Los Angeles and we left you, David.
Yeah.
The thought process behind it was, to be able to be part of prevention rather than intervention. Up until that point in my work as a psychotherapist, I found myself intervening when there was problems, which is fine. That's what a lot of my colleagues do.
Sure.
But, I got my master's as a second career. So I got my master's while I had a 2-year-old and a pregnant belly, right? So I tended to look at everything that I was learning through the lens of development. And all of a sudden it dawned on me. It was like, parents need to know this. Like, we can avoid so many problems, right? If we just get the first 5 years right. So that was the whole thought process behind it. I wanted to be a place where parents got information so they can make the right choices for their children. T. Barry Brazelton, which is the pediatrician of the United States, used to say that parents are are the experts of their children. And I believe that. Right. So Stop Parenting Alone is the answer to that. I want to be the person that gives you the information so you can make the right choices for you and your family.
And you just said the first 5 years. So is that primarily the focus of your work, that parents who are parenting during their early years of their kids' growth?
That was my initial plan.
Yeah.
And then I started growing up with the parents. and their babies.
As a parent, your kids started growing up, and right.
You know, my parenting journey started changing, and you know, in the end, today I work from zero all the way to 25. You know, one of my favorite workshops that I do locally in a school, that's the only workshop actually that the school wants me to come do, is Empty Nest. And it just kind of really thinking about what happens when they leave and now you have adult children. I love that conversation. Yeah, because you know, a lot of parents mess up. Like they send their kids off to college and then they come home and visit and then they're having fights about how to manage it. And I was like, did you forget that they were just like minding their own hours for like 6 months? Like, So I do all ages, but when we began, it was the first 5 years.
It was for primarily young kids, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so stop parenting alone. But that's not a that's not a reference to single parents. That's a reference to stop parenting without the information that is not widespread.
Correct. It is widespread. I mean, the parenting as a business is very expansive.
Right.
It's just that a lot of it is based on anecdotes and cultural myths and beliefs
rather
than development and brain science and, you know, all the good things that we are lucky enough to know now.
Right.
We didn't know that prior to the 90s.
So one of the things that emerged that became clear in as people learn more and more about teacher education and how to be a teacher is that if left to their own devices, teachers teach the way they were taught. And is that true about parenting? Is that without learning, essentially parents, they raise their kids like they were raised?
Yes.
And that's either good or bad.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And the reason for that is because of this organ right here, right, of our brain, right? Our brain, I always tell people, your brain is not intelligent, it's efficient, right? So our brain is constantly using experiences from our past to make sense of the present, right? And we don't have a parenting class, you know, in high school or college, right? The only experience that you have had in parenting is from your parents. Right. So when you have your little tiny offspring there, your brain is just going to bring to mind what was done for you. Now, what I find a lot of the time is that there's a lot of parents that do not want to parent the way that they were parented, right? They're like, I do not want to do what was done to me. So they pendulum swing to the complete polar opposite. And something that's not good either. Right?
My parents were really strict. And so I'm really permissive. My parents were really permissive. And so I'm going to be a Nazi.
Correct. Yeah. Exactly. Because that's what we do, right? We go, right? So back to why do I do what I do? I want to get everybody to the middle with good information so you can bring it your own flavor.
Maybe you'll save this for the end, but I'm going to ask you right now. But like, so what does the middle look like? Like, is there the magic bullet? Is there like, if everybody just did, right? I mean, is there a universal, like these are universals?
The middle is so hard to keep because it's so confusing for us. And it starts as early as when the baby starts crawling, right? We as parents are the ones that are setting the boundaries, which create an emotional response from our child, right? This emotional response from the child, everybody kind of responds to it in a different way. Mm-hmm. So we have to set a boundary. The child has an emotional response, but we also have to be the one that soothes simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And that's where things go awry. Because, you know, a 9-month-old, let's go for the most common one, right? 3-year-old has a brilliant idea because they're, I don't know if you've ever been around a 3-year-old.
Everything they think is brilliant.
Well, everything is fascinating to them. It's like, they're like, paper, you know, and this could be 100 things, right? And somewhere in their fifth try, some big human comes over to them and snatches the paper out of their hands, and they're like, ah! You know, because they were about to scratch their face, right? And they don't understand that, you know, that's gonna hurt, buddy, right? So a lot, the emotion, so it's correct to pull the paper away from the baby because we don't want them to get hurt. But the emotional response is what confuses the adult, because they don't understand that we set the boundary and we soothe. They don't know how to soothe without going, no, you know, either becoming like a circle, like, you know, like, hey, let me entertain you over here. And the easy thing is just to hold and go, oh, you really wanted to cut your face with the paper, but that will burn and that will hurt. So we have to do this. And this is what's good. So the middle is set the boundary, soothe simultaneously. Mm. And that's why it's so hard. Because sometimes this makes you angry, especially in the adolescent years, right? It's like,
I was about to say, so you're not just limiting that to the little 3-year-old. You're saying that dynamic happens throughout.
Forever.
Right.
Even when they're your adult children.
Right.
Right. Even, you know, it is what is two things that are incredible. And another thing about the middle, right? So that's how you respond to your baby, right? You set the boundary and you soothe simultaneously. Right. And then the other thing that's really hard about being a parent is that you have the balance of your own needs. Right, as the human being that you are, right, the adult that you are, versus the dependence of another being on you, right? And that's, you know, like, that is an incredibly difficult dilemma to manage, right? Because it's the parent-child relationship is the only healthy codependent relationship. They have to be dependent on us until they're independent, which is the ultimate goal of parenting, right? For teachers, their dilemma, because I'm in a lot of schools, and you know, I see the classroom from a different lens, right? I see the classroom through the lens of attachment and through the lens of like the social emotional needs of the classroom. I'm not like, you know, I tell teachers, I see a box, you see a unicorn. I don't do that. But I know how the little person is going to respond to that box like a unicorn, right? Mm-hmm. So in the classroom, that caregiver has to hold the group and the individual need of the children in the group. And they have that dilemma. So this is why the middle is so hard for all caregivers.
Would you give the same, you don't give the same advice to a teacher that you would to a parent? It's a whole different relationship, yeah, a whole different dynamic. And what you said, right? I mean, this teacher, you know, mom and dad have usually, right? And I'm dealing with this child. Maybe I've got another couple or whatever, but in the classroom, I'm dealing with this child while all those other kids have their own individual needs and group needs and, right. Yeah. It's impossible. Yeah. Nobody should ever go into education.
No, I like whenever I'm in a classroom, I'm like, why are you doing this? You're mine, right? But well, the difference between parents and teachers is that, and actually there's only one set of parents that has some semblance of what a teacher does, which is parents of multiples,
right?
Because teachers have a group of children in the same age group.
Right.
Parents may have more than one, but they're all in different spaces in their age group. So there's something about having a group of, you know, a group of kindergartners, right? Or so pre-K 3, kindergarten, 6th and 7th grade, I bow to them.
Right? Kindergartners always befuddled me. I just couldn't get it. I didn't get it.
People don't know this, right? There's 3 dirty R's in kindergarten: revenge, resentment, regret. When those little tiny people feel any of these, they feel regret. Oh, I shouldn't have done it. You know, and think about regret. It's such a hard feeling to tolerate and manage, right?
Yeah.
Then they get resentful.
You're also ashamed.
Yes, right. It's like, oh, why did I do that? Right. And then they're like 5 and 6 and they don't know what to do with themselves. So they feel resentment. It's your fault that I did that. Right. And then now I'm going to make you feel how I feel on the inside. Revenge. This is what these poor teachers have to deal with like, well, in a public school with 30 of them.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
30 little tiny people, you know, in revenge mode. I'm going to make you feel how I feel. It's hard. So yes, it's different, but at the end of the day, that idea of sitting with and soothing, which in our very punitive culture, we don't want to do, is actually sort of the answer most of the time.
And maybe you've already answered this, but have you run into, like, are there common mistakes, common errors that people make, you know, sort of across the board? Like, a lot of people do these things, and that, geez, if you could just tweak it that way, that would be so much better. Are there some commons?
Yeah. Number one common thing that people do is lack of consistency in how you respond. So
I can imagine anybody who's watching this is just like, that's, oh yeah.
Right. And because your consistency in how you respond to a boundary that you've set for the adult, back to the dilemma of, you know, how do I take care of my individual needs while I have this dependent creature, right? Or for a teacher, how do I take care of the group when I have this individual child that makes my classroom of 12 feel like a classroom of 42?
Right.
A lot of parents don't understand that.
No, right.
And when you have that one child, all of a sudden your classroom of 12 feels like 40 kids. It really does, right? So why they can't stay consistent is not because they're bad human beings, but it's based on your mood. Because sometimes you're just like, oh, here.
Right. Okay. Have another cookie.
Right. Because the little person's like, and if you're stressed out, and especially in the last 2 years, right? If your own stress response is off kilter, that staying the course and saying, baby, I know you really want this, but we don't have cookies before dinner.
Right.
And, you know, and what people think is that they say it, that it's one and done. But it's like, if you haven't done something consistently for 3 weeks, don't tell me that it didn't work.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you give a child a drop down menu of options, they're going to choose the part of the menu that they really like, as they should, because they're smart. Right. So consistency is one thing. Two, trying to make them happy. So I say this a lot.
Say more, yeah.
So the goal of caregiving, whether you're a parent or a teacher or a coach, is not, should never be happiness. The joy, the goal should be health and safety, emotional and physical. Right. And sometimes when we are giving health and safety to a child, a teenager, their emotional response to that is not joy.
No,
it's
right.
Frustration. It's disappointment. It's right. I hate you, you know. Right. So I think that's something that the older generation of parents kind of knew. Right. And I think that somewhere, I don't know where in our culture, it shifted to, we have to make them happy. You know, and I guess it's also kind of like the American way, because we're in the pursuit of happiness. And
yeah,
I wish people would pursue peace rather than happiness, you know, because happiness, just like sorrow, is fleeting, comes and goes. It's never the only emotion that we can hold is peace. Just to be like, okay, this is really hard right now, but let's see what I got to do next, right? Like, So I would say that those are the two things that people do that get them in trouble.
And the people who come knocking on your door, or in this case, knocking on your, you know, screen, do they come at a time of crisis? Do they come because like when it's like, I don't know what to do anymore. Everything's going in the wrong direction. I need help.
Right.
Oh, wait, there's Stop Parenting Alone. I'll go there.
Right. It varies. And it varies by age group and where you are in your little tiny parenting journey, right? So parents with children under 5, they are so ready and willing to for information. It's like, give me all the information, like sleep, potty, eating, all these like things that were like, my child is never going to go potty in the bathroom, right? They're very open to information. Mm-hmm. Parents of school age children, it's usually a learning difference or you know, there's something happens at school that causes the parent to reach assistance. And parents of teenagers, when they reach out for help, their head's on fire, like, you know, stuff has not, you know, things are not going well. So the reason for it varies. Fortunately, I'm kind of locally, at least in Miami, and a little bit in the Spanish market world, in the Latinx world, I am getting people to understand that I'm there for information. So that's how they show up, you know. I'm starting to get a group of, I love this new thing that's happening that I've noticed, of parents of middle schoolers that just want to get the adolescent years right.
You mean things are going okay and they just want to, that's amazing.
Yes, because I wish, you know, I think that those are the two times when, you know, like the school age years, you kind of get a little tiny respite. If you got 0 to 5 right, you kind of get a little like kind of like happy time between 7 and 9, you know, and then 10 through 12, it's when it starts getting dicey. I'm getting this nice set of parents there. They're anticipating the teenage years and they're coming, and they're like, what do I do? And, you know, and I'm the first one to tell parents that the adolescent years, the first thing we have to do is to remove this myth that you have to survive it. You don't have to survive the adolescent years. You just have to become a lighthouse in the adolescent.
Tell me what you mean. What does that mean?
Okay, I'll be corny because I always end my parent workshops with this. So I'll share it with you. So you ready? So the way that I see development of children is that from 0 to 5, you're building a boat together, right? You know, you're learning how to do things, right? And you're learning how to eat, how to walk, how to talk, you know, right? Between 5 and 9, you get in the boat, right? No, 5 and 11, you get in the boat. And together, the boat that you just built, right? You get in the boat together and you go into the waters, right? And, you know, between 9 and 11 is the how and why, you know, and you know, how do you deal with storms? How do you deal with calm? How are you a friend? How and why are you a friend? How and why you do school, right? And then from 12 forward, your child brings you to a chore, tells you to go in the lighthouse, and they get back in that boat and they go into the sea. Because the adolescent years is about how, why, and what do you think?
And what was that last one? Say again.
In the adolescent
how,
years.
How, why, and?
What do you think?
Oh, what do you think?
For the adolescent, right? Yeah. Which is what a lot of parents are like, I don't want to hear what they think. What they think is stupid. It's like, no. What they think is putting, you know, and why the lighthouse? Because a lighthouse is the place where the sailor comes to rest, when the sailor comes home, where the sailor needs a moment to touch and remember, right? And I always tell parents, what kind of lighthouse are you? Are you the one with like, wah, 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 you know, lights going off and, you know, the boat's like, oh, I'm kind of scared to go there? Or is there, you know, a warm cup of soup and a nice blanket and a place for them to just sit and remember, right? Like, so I, and again, you know, my kids are 14 and 17 now, right? And I used to say this, like, when they were little, I'd be like,
just made me feel so much older.
So yes, yes. The littles are now 14 and 17. And I used to say this prior to having teenagers. And the new information that I've gotten in my own parenting journey is that being a lighthouse is painful. Because if you are successfully launching your children into adulthood, they're leaving you. So I think this myth that you have to survive adolescence is because we didn't go deeper into what's actually happening for the adult, which is grief. Right? And for the child, they know that they're hurting you, but they're just hurting you by being themselves. Because they have to launch. Like, that's the whole point, people. The whole point of being a parent is to set off a citizen of the world into the world. And hopefully they know how to manage the world. So I am currently a lighthouse, and I try my best to have a warm soup and blankets every once in a while. You know, my lights are on and they don't want to come to the lighthouse.
Well, that's interesting you said, so the other thing that lighthouses do, speaking from my sailor years, is that they give you, when you're in the boat, they give you a touch point, right? Oh, there's the lighthouse. I was looking for that. It's like a reminder that the land is over there. And and sometimes they actually shed light on what you can't see.
Where you are.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
So
but they're not in the boat with the
sailor. Exactly. Yeah.
Right? The sailor has to, and that's why I love that idea, you know, that metaphor, right? So
have you had experiences where you watch your children make mistakes that you saw coming, but you didn't stop them from making those mistakes? You let them make those mistakes. Hopefully they didn't get too hurt by them, but yeah. So talk about that, because I think that's one of the, speaking from the days in education, that was one of the frustrating things about being in those situations, especially with parents who did not want their kids to fall, didn't want their kids, and I'm not talking about literally, maybe some, but didn't want their kids to fail the course. And so I'm going to either strap my kid to the chair and do the homework, or I'm going to do the homework and give it to them. And, you know, because had they not done the homework, they would have failed. Right. And I know failing is a bad thing, so I'm going to stop that.
Right. I think that we, back to this idea of our parenting journey, right? Parents are really great at letting children fail when they're little, right? We don't force them to walk, right? We just put the little tiny things in the corners of things so that they don't hit their head.
Hit their heads, right?
Right. We don't correct them when they say things poorly when they're learning to speak, right? And I like to remind parents of that. That's also true in the school age years with friendship, right? A lot of parents get in the way of children learning how to be friends.
Really? What do you mean?
She's mean and you shouldn't be hanging around with that little girl who's so disrespectful, blah, 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 right? But one of the primary social emotional development skills that we are building in the school age years is social awareness, right? The themes of power, the themes of impulse control, the themes of social reciprocity, you know, being able to do that back and forth, the themes of finding your little tribe when you're little, right? So that's a developmental marker that a lot of parents get in the way. And then in adolescence, have I allowed my, so throughout development, yes, I most definitely have watched as my children are on their way to run into a wall. And how I am able to do that is because I understand that the hip is actually the teacher. Mm-hmm. And my intervening is my interrupting a lesson. Mm-hmm. You know, like my
son. Oh, wow. That's really, I almost want to ask you to say it again because it's exactly, well, that sounds so right. Is that
yes,
you getting in the way of the lesson just upends the lesson. They're going to have to learn it eventually, or worst case scenario, they never learn it. And then a lifetime of that mistake again and again until they do.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Which is actually what is happening in college, mm-hmm. right? They're having issues with in their social world. They're having issues in organizing and planning so that they can get their coursework done. They're having issues with having a conversation with their professor. You know, they evaded and avoided until, you know, their head's on fire, mm-hmm. Because you never allowed them to have a conversation with you where they disagreed with you. Right. Mm-hmm. Or you solve the problem for them. I don't want anybody to go to college without these skills. Right. And so what ends up happening, they get into the amazing Ivy League, woohoo, but they don't graduate from it because they have to go back home to their manager and their planner and their organizer. Because if you don't allow your children to make decisions as they should, because it's part of development, right? What is happening in the adolescent years for the brain? The upper cortex of the brain, which is the space where we think, where we create, you know, memories and stories and we make decisions, is happening. That's why they talk back. They're not talking back because they're being disrespectful. They're talking back just like when they were pulling up to walk, because their brain wants to problem solve, make decisions, see things from more than one way. So when a parent says, stop, I want every parent to be like, it's just like when they were walking, right? Yes, they're lousy at debating with us, but that debate is necessary for that upper cortex. And I invite all parents of adolescents to allow their adolescent to disagree with them, because I want you to think of them at 32. Mm-hmm. You're teaching them how to have a conversation with another adult, with an authority figure, in a way where they get to speak what they believe, to make their case, and to have the reciprocity of that. Again, that's the one place where I let my kids just like mess up terribly with me, right? When they disagree with me, right? Where I'm like, okay, tell me why you think that you should, you know, fill in the blank. Because it's usually some kind of like, let's rethink this boundary of yours. You know, I guess my husband and I, Ty and I, have, you know, we're lucky because we've seen many adolescents and we can trust that it's the right thing to do. I think for some parents, it's terrifying because when they make mistakes in the adolescent years, they're big mistakes sometimes.
Yeah.
But
not as big as, you know, my famous line, not as big as when the end result is a federal indictment. So luckily they have that time to make mistakes. And if they're not allowed to make those mistakes, then sometimes they make them when the result is an arrest or.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, like, I mean, with my son, because he's the one that's been more prone to making big mistakes, because, you know, my daughter's a little more meticulous. She's not typical. You know, the one thing he always would forget his violin, his viola. He was playing the viola like in fourth grade. And, you know, I wouldn't turn around to pick it up again. I'm like, you forgot it. So you got to tell your teacher, you know, and he did it like four times and then that was it. Right. And then, he, you know, forgetting, he always would lead things. So that was the big mistake for him. And a lot of parents would have driven back, gotten the viola and dropped it off in the office at school. And it's like, why? Mm-hmm. He's in fifth grade. He can mm-hmm. show up with egg in his face and tell his teacher that he forgot his viola, you know? So little things like, yes, yeah. yes. So the answer to your question with a really long answer is yes, mistakes are necessary. Mistakes build the muscle of problem solving. Mistakes build the muscle of tolerating disappointment. Mm-hmm. Mistakes build the muscle of tolerating, you know, frustration.
You know, there was a book, actually a pair of books years back written by a woman whose name, will I remember it? Yes, I think it was Wendy Mogul. And she wrote a book years ago called something like The Blessing of a Skinned Knee.
Oh, and that's great.
It was great. It was a great title. I don't recall if the book was great, but I think it was.
And there's
and
a
the blessing
book.
Of a B minus.
Oh, yes, yes. One. Yes, there's another book that I absolutely love and I like teachers and parents to read, which is called The Gifts of Failure by, her last name is Leahy. She's an educator, but it's a great book just making the, and her both as a teacher and as writing from the point of view of a teacher and a parent, just telling on herself, right? It was like, I could never do this, you know? So The Gifts of Failure, if you have a 10-year-old, buy it as a, you know, planning ahead for the book. Like I think that the time to really kind of let go and let loose and allow them to just, you know, make a lot of mistakes is between 10 and 15, right? The middle school years are the best years to just let them, you know, turn in the paper late, to, you know, to not get to get the F in the science report because they didn't tell you on time that you had to go get the supplies. Like that's the time, because we don't want them to do that in high school.
Right.
But people hold on too long.
Yeah.
So,
you know, it occurred to me, your work, so much of your work is in social emotional learning, and you live in a state that has recently, or at least the governor, and I suspect more than the governor, has come out in a vigorous way against the idea of social emotional learning. That somehow it's a creeping, you know, it's a way for the left to do something to the right. So what is that? Do you feel the tension there, and has it had any effect on your business, or is that just coming out of the mouth of the governor and certain prominent people?
I don't feel it in my day-to-day work. However, the state and also in the school districts that I kind of have, you know, predominant parents that are in those districts, which is West Palm, Broward, and Miami-Dade County, right? Those school boards are kind of not gonna follow so much, mm-hmm. but if it keeps happening, you know, the funding is going to
sure.
decrease
right.
for social emotional learning. So I think that we still hold tight to this idea that brain science has already kind of debunked time and again, but you know, the science doesn't necessarily kind of
no.
go hand in hand with
right.
culture, which is that that a child has to feel bad to learn a lesson,
right?
Or this concept of rewards and consequences that is so rampant in our society, which we know brain-wise is not true, right? The minute a child feels bad, they defend, right? So they stop learning, you know? And the minute we sit with and say, hey, whoa, then they can learn a lesson, then they can move further, which is, I think that's the simplest form of thinking about social emotional learning, right? So I think that it's coming. I think that the restrictions and the laws that they are placing inevitably, you know, it's coming down the pipe, maybe not this school year, but next school year, because at the end of the day, you know, funding is everything in the public school system.
Sure.
But today it hasn't touched. But it, what's so interesting is that it doesn't match what the parents want, right? The parents want, even the most conservative parent, they want their child to be healthy, social, and happy at school, right? So that's why I feel like we have to educate parents, which is what I do, to tell them, well, how do we get healthy, happy, you know, available to learn children, and it's with social emotional learning. So I, unfortunately, you know, some in the political world are just trying to get votes, yeah, and they're saying things that they don't believe. Because the funniest thing, and I can't remember the campaign, but his wife, the first lady of the state of Florida, has created a program to help addiction. That's her.
Wait, you just vagued out for a second. There was a glitch in the feed. So,
oh, sorry.
She created a program that what?
So her, you know how first ladies tend to have like something that they're working towards, and I forget the name of the campaign, but it's all about addiction, right? And changing and helping, and it's all about mental health. I mean, I love her campaign. I think it's wonderful. I mean, she's really, because the panhandle has a big issue with addiction in the state of Florida.
You know, it just dawned on me. So you've been doing this, you've been doing what you're doing for quite some time. And there was a change that happened, you know, 2015 and the years after that, and I don't think it stopped. Where the then president, you know, was doing all sorts of things that that parents tell their kids, don't do that and don't do that, and teachers tell their kids, don't do that, don't make fun of this kid, don't make fun of, like, well, all that stuff, don't call people names, and then the leaders, right, and especially a particular leader, but then the leaders, you know, the adults who hold an enormous amount of prestige, probably more so in young people's minds, are doing those very things. And people are screaming at each other at board meetings and yada, yada, yada. And so has that affected the kids? Like how does, you know, well, bullying, right? I mean, here's a president who is ridiculing and bullying, one might say bullying, people he's running against, people who say things that he doesn't like, and now they go to school and say, no bullying. Hey, no bullying. So have you watched this affect children, or is it not? Is it just, you know, business as usual there?
It depends on the age group. I think the littles still, you know, this idea of being friends and being kind to one another and using kind words, you know, that's still available to them. Mm-hmm. I think fifth grade and up is when they start kind of dipping deeper into the culture, and that's when they actually, there was a moment where they used Trump as a verb. So like you're trumping someone when you were being when you were using power inappropriately, you know. Dude, you're like, so it was kind of like, I don't know, I'm not on TikTok, but they were, it was, I heard it, which was interesting, but they weren't using it as in in a powerful way. It was just kind of like just one more thing to describe.
Yeah.
You know, using power in an inappropriate way, you know, and I think that the acceptance of this is actually a little bit, you know, the result of this bully campaign that we've created in schools. And, you know,
so say more, tell me more.
So two things, right? One, we've begun to bully the bully, right? And two, we've created this atmosphere where children, right, from kindergarten all the way through high school are either victims or perpetrators. And we stopped talking about choice, right? And I think that when you give a child choice, like when a child only has the choice of being a victim or a perpetrator, if you're smart, what are you going to be?
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. You're going to look for power. And I think that that's happening a lot. You know, that's somebody who uses power in the way that our last president used it. Right. And power as a way to, you know, from top down to control rather than to work with. It's about control. You could see how in this world of like victims and perpetrators in the school system, right? I'm gonna choose that power. I'm gonna choose to be the big one. I'm gonna choose the one to be in control. So in my little fantasy world, you know, our schools would become more a place where we assist and help all of the above, right? Where we help. And it begins super early, right? It begins in you know, pre-K all the way to second grade, where actually normally the human being is learning how to be one of many, right? And within that capacity, when a little person hits or pushes or punches, they don't get called a bully, but they get told, whoa, you weren't able to hold your anger. And these are your choices when you're angry. Rather than you're angry, you're gonna get a zero in the app. You know, I forget the name of the app, but we're not gonna advertise for them. You know, where you know you get a reward and you get a punishment and you get a reward and you get a consequence. When actually that little person needs to know you're really angry and frustrated and overwhelmed right now. I need you to take.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.